morning, high upon the gallows tree, Kevin Barry gave his young life for the cause of liberty.
The amazing voice of the African-American singer and civil rights activist Paul Robeson there, singing Kevin Barry. It's probably one of the best-known Irish rebel ballads and tells the story of 18-year-old Kevin Barry, the IRA volunteer who was executed in November 1920 during the War of Independence. I'm Therese McIntyre, and in this episode of Hero Songs, I'm exploring the rebel ballads of the period 1919 to 1921 in what's sometimes called the Anglo-Irish War, or more colloquially, the Black and Tan War. Songs like Shall My Soul Pass Through Old Ireland, about Terence McSweeney, the Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of Cork, who died on hunger strike in Brixton Prison just days before Kevin Barry was hanged.
In a dreary Brixton prison, where an Irish soldier lay, by his side a priest was standing, ere his soul should pass away.
Shall My Soul Pass Through Old Ireland, the Terence McSweeney ballad to the same air as Kevin Barry, sung there by the late Bridie Gallagher. And then there's Dominic Bean with his own song and one of the ballads about Sean Tracy, the South Tipperary IRA leader who started the conflict in 1919 and who died in a shootout with British officers in Talbot Street in October 1920.
For a chance to die, I hear them say, how Tracy met defeat. Our lovely Sean is dead and gone, shot down in a Talbot Street.
Dominic Bean and his rather bloodthirsty ballad, Sean Tracy. Now, except for Kevin Barry, most of these songs are rarely sung or heard today. It's not just that they fell out of favor, but from the early 1970s, with the growing conflict in Northern Ireland and the emergence of the modern IRA, these songs and those of 1916 became toxic. At the beginning of 1971, the Irish government, led by Jack Lynch, introduced broadcasting censorship under Section 31, which banned not only the IRA from the airwaves, but anything seen to advocate violence, including the genre of rebel songs.
Good evening. Last Friday, the Minister for Posts and Telegraphs issued a direction in writing to the RTE authority to refrain from broadcasting any matter of the following class, that is, any matter that could be calculated to promote the aims or activities of any organisation which engages in, promotes, encourages, or advocates the attaining of any particular objective by violent means.
Section 31 remained in place until 2001, post the Good Friday Agreement. Mark Brennick reported on the Northern Ireland conflict during the 80s and 90s for the Irish Times, and he remembers as a child in the 60s listening to these songs being played by the Irish Army Band.
My father was the conductor of the Army No. 1 Band throughout the 1960s and 1970s, and they would play concerts every other weekend in people's parks. But I remember going down regularly to the bandstand on Dunleary Pier to watch them playing, and they'd play a medley of songs from Burt Bacharach and musicals and so on, a medley of marches from the States and so on, and then a medley of these songs, Kevin Barry, A Nation Once Again, various Irish Republican ballads, which at that stage everyone just sang along to. The events of which they were based were a long time past, and they were part of our culture and part of what we are. And suddenly this changed when the violence erupted in Northern Ireland in the late 1960s. All of a sudden, singing "And Ireland Long a Province Will Be a Nation Once Again" meant something real, meant something quite different. These became the anthems, I suppose, of violent republicanism in the North. And as a result, people started to feel very uncomfortable about playing music down here, which some of it was about killing British soldiers, was about celebrating some of the exploits of Sean South of Garryowen and so on. So suddenly these songs became quite toxic in a culture in the Republic of Ireland, which partly had a sympathy for the nationalists in Northern Ireland and partly didn't want very much to do with it. I suppose my father came from a generation and from a tradition that was steeped in the Irish national story. He was born, coincidentally, in 1916. His own father had fought in the War of Independence and then had gone with the Michael Collins side, with the Colin O'Gale side, after independence. He joined the army in 1936 when he was 20 years of age. And throughout those years, a central role of the Irish Army Band was to play that kind of music at great events and small events. Throughout the 1960s in particular, they meant something relatively harmless. They were a celebration of Irishness and what we were and so on. But we didn't think of the words. And then when the violence started in the north, you thought very much of the words. And if the words were about killing and about murder and about sacrifice and all that kind of thing, suddenly the meaning of the songs changed entirely for people.
Mark Brennick and his father, the late Colonel John Brennick, and you're listening to the Irish Army Band from the 30s there. Singer Francis Black remembers these songs being taught at school in the 60s and then disappearing completely.
I went to school in St. Louis in Rathmines, and Sister Herman used to be our choir teacher. And I remember we used to go in every morning and we'd be singing songs like A Nation Once Again, and we'd be singing songs like Boule of Ogue and Kevin Barry. And we sang all of those songs right up until 1966. De Valera was at the time president of Ireland, and I remember De Valera coming to visit us and we sang for him. And then all of a sudden it started to change. And we weren't allowed to sing those songs anymore. It didn't stop me from singing them, but, you know, there was a sadness in that, why people kind of thought it was a negative.
Give me a parabellum and a couple of hundred shell.
Veteran journalist Seamus Martin has a vivid memory of just how popular these songs were.
The songs were quite popular, you know, and it was almost a tourist attraction in many ways, because in the Abbey Tavern in Howth, foreign tourists who went on tours of Dublin were taken out there to have a meal and listen to what they were called rebel songs at the time. And I remember particularly an elderly Italian friend of our family who was quite shocked, not particularly about the songs, but by the reaction of the Irish people in the audience to them, who were, you know, shaking their fists and shouting, etc.
Yet how those English soldiers paled, went out into the night. Sean sent a stream of leaden hail, challenging them to fight.
My mother, I don't know if she ever sang any of these songs herself. My mother was a professional singer at one stage in her life, but she would have sung things like The West's Awake, stuff before these rebel songs came into vogue. But she did tell me that she was in town on the day that Sean Tracy was shot. And she came from a very strong Republican family in Dublin, in any event. But she saw the commotion around North Earl Street, Talbot Street area. And when she heard that it was Sean Tracy, she was quite taken aback, because he was a bit of a hero at the time. You know, the people in those times, my mother was one of six sisters, and you'd hear them get together talking about things. Their attitude was quite fantastic in that they'd say, remember the night we were going to the dance and there was an ambush and we all had to hide in a doorway? And they're laughing away at this as if it was a, you know, this was the sort of thing that was happening all the time in those days.
Come out, you black and tan, come out and fight me like a man. Show your wife how you won medals down in Flanders. Tell her how the IRA made you run like hell away from the green and lovely lanes in Killeshandra.
But what was this war that came just 3 years after the Rising? We're listening to another song written by Dominic Behan, Come Out Ye Black and Tans.
The sneers and jeers that you bravely let us hear when our leaders of 16 were executed.
I went to Trinity College Dublin to talk to historian Eunan O'Halpin. Eunan is not just an expert on the period, but it's part of his own family history, as he is a grandnephew of Kevin Barry.
Ireland, you could argue, was in political turmoil from 1912 onwards because of the unresolved issue of home rule and how Ulster would be treated. In 1914, the outbreak of the First World War in some ways postponed the Irish question. In other ways, it deepened and sharpened it because it provided the opportunity for a very small group of Irish revolutionaries, both deeply nationalist and a small group of socialist republicans, to have a rebellion in Ireland in 1916, backed by Britain's enemies. Ironically, the gallant allies in Europe were far more reactionary as society and a state, far less democratic than was the United Kingdom. And from 1916 onwards, really the Home Rule argument had almost disappeared. Nationalist Ireland now wanted something far more than the British government was willing to deliver. At the end of the war, in December 1918, the general election in Ireland sees Sinn Féin win 73 of the 105 Irish seats, right? My great-grandfather, P.J. Maloney, Tipperary, was one of the TDs who elected. The Dáil is founded in January 1919, claiming to be the parliament and government of the Irish people. On the very same day, by chance, in Maloney's constituency of Tipperary, occurs an ambush in which two policemen are shot dead escorting a loaded gelignite by two men who become famous for that and other acts, Dan Breen and Sean Tracy. Now, it's pretty clear that they did intend to strike a blow. They didn't intend simply to steal the gelignite. They wanted to shed some British blood as they saw it, although, of course, the two constables were Irishmen like themselves.
It's that ambush, when Tracy and Breen killed two local RIC policemen, Patrick O'Connell and James McDonnell, which ignited a war. After it, Tracy and Breen effectively became an archetype for IRA gunmen. Here's Dan Breen, who later became a politician, from an interview in the 50s on that campaign.
In guerrilla warfare, there's no such thing as kid gloves. You've got to kill, and you can't leave anyone alive after, because if you do, you're going to get your innocent people executed. You murder so-and-so and so-and-so. Yes, I killed him. I said, all killing is murder to me. I make no apology for killing. And the only real thing I was ever sorry was the number escaped.
Sean Tracy became part of Michael Collins's unit, known simply as the Squad.
May the Lord have mercy on your soul.
It features in the Michael Collins movie when they assassinate the so-called Cairo Gang, who were British agents.
Give me the mail, would you? That's for a job on Friday.
Dominic Bean wrote the Sean Tracy ballad in the 1950s. It relates how Tracy died in a shootout.
Give me a parabellum and a couple hundred shells. Lead me to the Mulder gang. We'll blow them all to hell.
Dermot Branagh, who sings with the Gaeilge Traditional Singers Club, admires Behan and the song, but questions its accuracy.
I think he was kind of in love with the Parabellum revolver, which he features in a number of his songs. It certainly was a weapon that was used at the time, but it's just interesting the way he starts off that song with Give Me a Parabellum. It starts talking about filling the Cairo gang with lead. I think also sometimes he was inaccurate. In the song, he calls a challenge out to the British. I doubt he did that in real life. I bet he was trying to get away and trying to distract them with fire, maybe kill a few of them. But his primary objective would have been to get away, and it would have been what would be expected of him. But the song emphasises his preparedness to die, his preparedness to fight, and I suppose calls us to dislike or hate the ones who killed him. I'd rather edit out historical inaccuracies from songs. I'm fine with some hyperbole and stuff like that. The object of a song is not just to record an event, it's also to stir emotions. These songs definitely do put you in their shoes.
If the songs put you in their shoes, as Dermot says, they are often uncomfortable shoes, as these are songs that are meant to fire up emotions, like hatred. Maura Cronin, historian at Mary Immaculate College Limerick, makes the point that these songs are meant to be propaganda, romanticised versions rather than factual history.
A good historian tries to look at both sides. I think ultimately one is biased, but a song can't be other than biased. If it is, I don't think it's a song.
Oh, the sun might set, but it's gold rise, and the bitter fight was o'er. A brave boy's deep beneath the clay, and the cert they are no more. And the mountains shone o'er the battlefield where a dying rebel lay. His arms were crossed, his body stressed, his lifeblood flowed.
Maura remembers another Sean Tracy song, Tipperary So Far Away.
You know, the Sean Tracy song, I know, talks about blood flowing and that it's romantic blood. He's lying there with his arms crossed and the blood is flowing. It's all very romantic. Whereas, in fact, somebody who has been shot is not a pretty sight. And, of course, that's one of the things that these songs do, is that they put a kind of a veil of romanticism over the very horrible picture, which is a gutted body.
Gaelic club singer Frank Nugent sees songs like Tipperary So Far Away as a partisan but important part of folk memory.
The great thing about folk song is that they are the people's memory. The historians will put the facts and figures down, the date, the time, the place, who you were shot with, and the circumstances, whatever. But the people will remember. So if someone is dear to the heart of the people, or if they are sympathetic, or the people believe in the person, the song will survive. The song will outlive everything.
Sean Tracy who died, he's home to say, it's Tipperary so far away.
Brian Corrigan there singing Tipperary So Far Away. Just 11 days after Sean Tracy's death, Terence McSweeney, the Sinn Féin Lord Mayor of Cork, died in Brixton Prison after a 74-day hunger strike.
And he faintly murmured, Father, as he clasped him by the hand, tell me this before I die, shall my soul pass through our land?
The florid ballad, Shall My Soul Pass Through Old Ireland, sung here by Frank McCaffrey. Now, McSweeney was a playwright, a poet, more a cultural than a military Republican. Here's Eunan O'Halpin.
McSweeney was sentenced to a couple of years for sedition. He was removed to prison in London. He went on hunger strike. But McSweeney becomes a cause célèbre. And again, I think that it's not simply that he's an IRA man, but that he also has the title of Lord Mayor of Cork, because this has a resonance and a kind of sense of propriety and dignity, which means that internationally it sounds as though he is some sort of respectable patron of the arts and paragon of municipal government and so on, and particularly as he was succeeding Tomás McCurtain, who had been assassinated by the police. So it began to look internationally as though the British weren't simply killing sort of young, crazed, out-of-control gunmen. Now they were allowing respectable burghers, pillars of society, to die rather than make concessions which would allow them to live. McSweeney's hunger strike was very extended and incredibly difficult period, especially for his family, especially his poor wife Muriel, who had a young daughter, more to think of.
Now, the song has a deeply religious context. We don't know who wrote it, but it's set to the same tune as that used for Kevin Barry, which ironically is an old English folk song, Rolling Home to Dear Old England. But it goes beyond making a hero of McSweeney and turns him into a type of Catholic martyr. Here's Frank Nugent and Maura Cronin on the song's tone.
There's an element of sainthood about the person as a martyr. And in Catholic lore, a martyr goes straight to heaven. In those days, you didn't just die for Ireland, you died for your religion, you died for your county, your place.
That whole idea of martyr, as in the case of Kevin Barry, is being used at the time. The word martyr, dying for Ireland, you're dying for a cause, is martyrdom. And of course the fact that a man is on hunger strike adds to that, of which a bit like Bobby Sands and the others who died in the 80s.
As Maura Cronin says, the myth-making around McSweeney is echoed in the way Bobby Sands and the IRA hunger strike in the 1980s is treated, as in Christy Moore's ballad of the time, which links Bobby Sands to Robert Emmett.
Robert Emmett to Bobby Sands MP, who was given 30,000 votes while in captivity.
You see, I think anyone can make that connection, because what are you looking at? You're looking at people who quote-unquote die for Ireland, you know, and therefore you go back in this kind of unbroken chain, which does, I should stress as a historian, does ignore the very interesting and deep differences that are between different periods, different individuals.
Early on Leonard Cohen breaking into a rendition of Kevin Barry at his 1972 Dublin concert. The ballad's been covered hundreds of times, and while its author is, like so many of these songs, unknown, it first appeared shortly after Barry's execution. But who was Kevin Barry? Historian Eunan O'Halpin told me about his granduncle, who was just 18 when he was captured during a bungled IRA operation in which three British soldiers were killed while the soldiers were collecting bread at a Dublin bakery.
It's important to emphasise he was a middle-class boy from a relatively privileged background. He'd been to two well-known schools and he was then a medical student. And I think that part of the impact of his trial and later his execution lay in these social factors as well as in his undoubted courage once he was captured, and as well as in the brutality with which he was treated when he was interrogated. It's also the fact that he was somebody whom, for example, the media, not only nationally but in Britain, oh my God, a medical student. He was the same age and the same profile as so many young men of the British elite who had died in the First World War.
As he walked to death that morning, he proudly held his head on high. Another martyr for Auld Erin, another murder for the crown.
Tommy Makeham and the Clancy Brothers singing Kevin Barry there. Barry's execution came just 5 days after Terence McSweeney's death. Fellow UCD students later raised funds for a memorial window at Earlsford Terrace, and in 2007 it was moved to Belfield. I went to have a look at it and met Ruth Ferguson, curator of Newman House, UCD's first home.
We're standing now in the Charles Institute, which is part of the Health Sciences or Medical School for UCD. And we're standing in front of the wonderful Kevin Barry Memorial Window. The bottom panel depicts the taking of Kevin Barry after the incident in Church Street by the British Army. And hovering above it, going through to two panels, is a much larger image of the martyred young hero, Kevin Barry, surrounded by the flames, purple and blue flames of martyrdom. So the whole spirit of this piece of wonderful glass is the glorification of the nationalist dead in the Irish struggle for independence. And that's what's depicted here.
Another murder for the crown. The British laws may crush the Irish, but cannot keep their spirits down.
Eunan O'Halpin shared one of the last letters Barry wrote to his friends the day before his execution.
It's a letter, I think, to Jerry McAleer, his Belvedereian and UCD friend, who afterwards became an RAF officer and a medical advisor to the Queen, which shows you the ironies of history. It begins, "I was glad to see you yesterday looking so fit and well. Also the boys. But I'll hardly get a chance of seeing you any more. Hence this. I'll write to the boys if possible, but in any case, I'm more glad than you can imagine to have seen the three of you together for old time's sake." He goes on, "Now, Jerry, I can't indulge in heroics, nor I can't curse, so this is a very tame letter. Not at all like the ones you used to get from me, but you'll make allowances. The letter would be censored, you see, by the authorities. Give my best wishes to any old Belvedereans you meet. It's unnecessary to state you've all my best wishes for success in everything, even love." And it goes on again. "There are several people in the college, that's UCD, I'd like to write to, but I've neither the time nor energy. But when the second meds are assembled, tell them, boys and girls, that I wish them every success and ask them to say a prayer for me when I go over the top on Monday. PTO, the other side is P.S. Goodbye now and remember me to all at home. Your pal, Kevin." So he even uses the motif, "Go over the top," which is a Western Front, First World War motif. So I think this is absolutely, if I'm going to be executed, in some ways I'm not going to give anybody the pleasure, my enemies the pleasure of thinking that I go to my death either simply bound up in prayer or that I go to my death pleading for mercy.
In Mountjoy Jail one Monday morning, high upon the gallows tree.
We opened the program with the beautiful recording made by Paul Robeson. Now, the ballad had appeared in the US in a songbook from 1927, so it's quite likely Robeson had heard it being sung. But the story goes he learnt the words from Republican activist and veteran of the Spanish Civil War, Padraig O'Donnell, after a chance meeting when Robeson's limo stopped to help the stranded O'Donnell. Robeson later released it on his album, Songs of Struggle.
I grew up hearing that song, obviously, both on the radio to some extent and on the Paul Robeson recording. It was simply part of the fabric of family memory. I do think that Paul Robeson verse is beautiful anyway. He's such a wonderful singer. As with many ballads like this, you might quibble at not so much the sentiments, but even of the detail. But I think the downside of it is that it has a slightly sort of sepulchral, this martyr stuff and this Cammy Sandy to attention. And I won't say Catholic, but Christian air to it. And the nice thing about Kevin Barry is he seems to have been a pretty loose Catholic, you know, appropriate for his age. He found appropriate consolation in the church, but he didn't behave as though he was terrified to go and meet his God. He behaved as though he was sorry to be leaving his friends and his family. And I think the song kind of touches on that. But he was more fun than the song might suggest.
Then to death walked softly smiling, that old island might be free.
Seamus Martin, like Eunan O'Halpin, loves the Robeson version, but thinks these songs in general have lost their relevancy, while O'Halpin believes they help us remember and frame the past.
You know, if you listen to these songs today, there is a feeling that they just don't belong in our era. But in their own day, they were part of, you know, what the Germans called the zeitgeist of what was in people's minds at the time. So their relevance after the 1970s kept diminishing until nowadays. They're now regarded as a sort of an historical curiosity more than anything else.
Well, I think songs from this era or from any past era have two qualities. They have a quality of encouraging us to remember the past, but also they have a quality of framing the past. And remembrance and framing aren't the same thing. And I do think that most successful songs linked to periods in history are very often in detail and in nuance questionable. But what can't be questioned is their enduring power.
Eunan O'Halpin there. Next week, I'll be exploring the hero songs, or lack of them, of Irish women, including one rewritten by 1916 leader Padraig Pearse to commemorate the pirate queen Gran Uaill. Here's Sinead O'Connor's version to see us out. Oh,